Welcome to the MS Dev Show, episode number 147. This week, we talk with Jason R. Shaver about the new Azure CLI 2.0. PowerPoint is Turing complete and needs to be removed from the Apple App Store. And I finally have quantifiable proof that Carl is a slacker.
This episode of the MS Dev Show is brought to you by Espose, the market leader of .NET and Java APIs for file business formats. Natively work with DocX, XSLX, PPT, PDF, MSG, MPP, image formats, and many more.
This week, we have Jason R. Shaver. He's the program manager for the Azure Command Line Tools. He joined Microsoft in 2011 after falling in love with using XAML for a line of business apps. But now he's walking in with a MacBook looking to help folks get started in the cloud, regardless of their computer brand. How's it going, Jason?
Oh, it's doing great. Today's a good day. Yeah. It's 65 degrees out here today.
Yeah, I know. I'm sorry. I was like, oh man, we have to record a podcast today indoors. We should have figured out a way to do an outdoor episode because I was outside. It's just beautiful. On the news, they told everybody just to not go into work today and just enjoy the day. But thank you for joining.
Glad to be here.
Yeah. So Carl, why are you such a slacker?
I am a slacker. I actually have like 15 Slack groups that I'm a part of.
Yeah.
I recently did a little bit of a culling, but then we decided to add another one, didn't we, Jason?
Yep. That
so if, one. Yeah. So if you want to kind of become part of our community here with the MS Dev Show, you can sign up at slack.msdevshow.com and join us and talk to us whenever we're around.
Yep. Yeah. It's just a good way to interact with us and provide feedback, ask questions, those types of things.
Yep. Just trying to make ourselves a little bit more accessible.
Absolutely. And what do we have for the comment of the week?
The comment of the week, once again, is brought to us by Espose. And this week, the comment of the week gets a developer small business license for Espose.total for .NET, which includes all of the Espose.net products in one package. And we got a comment off of our website from Darren Evans. And he said, there needs to be greater sharing of the benefits of efficiency that technology brings. The 8-hour day, 5 days a week work time structure was brought to us in the early 1800s. I'm paraphrasing here because it's a pretty big
this guy's obviously comment. Sophisticated, too. He's very eloquent.
It says, like, why is so much of the world still working this closely with minor variances to this archaic pattern, given the time and efficiency increases that we have, both mechanical and digital technology brings us? Even in an economy needs to be enjoying the benefits of increased efficiency by being given a share of the time savings to spend on improved work-life balance needs.
Well,
instead,
Jason,
it seems... Oh, yeah, and he goes on a little bit more.
Yeah.
But, you know, that's one of the things I think is really interesting. If you look at some of the basic income theories and experiments that are going out there with a couple of countries in Europe and are being tossed around here, I think that's one of the ways that we're looking in a modern way to try to, you know, one, spread the wealth, and two, kind of bring a little bit more of that utopian future thing that was promised to us, even by cartoons like the Jetsons. I don't know if you remember, but they had like 3-day work weeks where you work 2 or 3 hour shifts. Pushing a button, and you know, that was painful.
Yeah. I mean, the point is that there's all this automation, yet we work the same as we used to. And it's really just because Jason is buying, you know, the latest and greatest MacBooks. So that's one explanation, but,
this up with Slack, where you could look at something like Slack, which allows you to have constant communication with your customers and your partners, but you, at the same time, you don't want to fall into the 8-hour day and then Slack for another 4 hours, and now you have a 10-hour day.
Yeah.
But if you can use Slack to cut that 8-hour day to a 6-hour day of more productivity, a 4-hour day of more productivity, I think that's a great thing, and I think the industry's heading there.
Yeah, absolutely. So that was a great comment, Darren.
I got to finish this up, Jason. If you want to get mentioned on the show like Darren, send us an email to feedback@msdevshow.com or comment on Facebook, YouTube, or Stitcher. We especially like those 5-star iTunes reviews.
Perfect. I'm just excited about the news. We got some good stuff. So the first thing is Azure IoT Central. And this this made a big splash just a couple days ago. The short version of this one, if I were to summarize, it's basically like a SaaS version of IoT. So previously, you know, you had to go into like your Azure portal and build a solution with all of the different IoT pieces. What this is doing is basically taking some of that, putting it together and making it so that you can, if you're an enterprise that has devices and you want to get dashboards and get some of this other value out of it, you can just use this solution and put those things together. So at this point, my understanding, it's just an announcement. There's a video out there that shows, you know, some of the things that are going to be coming out around the corner. And then that sort of leads into time series insights. And this one, you can actually play around with this one. So Azure Time Series Insights is a service for storing time series data and then allowing you to do things like look for anomalies or look for different patterns in the data. It does some really cool visualizations with the data. And this is an Azure service. So you just go into Azure, it's in public preview. You say, give me one of those. It'll hook up to Event Hubs or IoT Hub, start pumping data in, and then you can start exploring your data in real time. And time series data tends to be like, you know, super fine grained, you know, like millions and millions of values. And this is optimized for those types of scenarios. Any comments, questions on that, guys?
No, I haven't tried the time series one yet, but I'm working right now on a lot of time series data. So it'd be really interesting kind of seeing how this compares to the reporting that we're already doing and seeing what else, what other things that we can glean out of the information that we already have.
Absolutely. Yeah. The people that this would be of interest to, I mean, are pretty excited about this. So it's a really cool service. Modernizing the DOM tree in Microsoft Edge. What's this all about, Carl?
So I thought this was a really cool article because they kind of talked about like the history of how Internet Explorer has kind of constructed and maintained the idea of the DOM. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they talked about like really how up until even very recently they were looking at the DOM from like a 90s point of view. You had very simple tags and images and they were – the backing structures were still like strings and they had just like optimized like how they did that string manipulation really quickly. Mm-hmm. But with the modern web, it's demanding a little bit more, especially when you have a lot of dynamic elements. And they go really through on how they've modernized the internals of just representing every element on the page and how that helps speed up the web experience in Microsoft Edge. So if you want like a really cool history lesson and kind of like where technology in the web is going right now, this is a really cool article to look into.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the summary is Edge is faster now.
Way faster.
Way faster.
And it even has a few benchmarks in there that are Jeff Atwood approved. So he loves his benchmarks.
Yeah. Yeah, what was his comment? He said, kudos to Microsoft. Latest Edge version is nearly 50% faster on Browser Bench / Speedometer and now crushes Firefox. So very cool. Oh, yeah, he's got a whole bunch of things in here. Latest Edge is also 2 times faster for Ember. Finally, some change I can believe in. Good work, Edge team. Yeah, very nice work. I mean, I love it. It's great whenever you have all these under the hood improvements that speed things up and don't really require you to do anything different. Free performance is sounds good to me. How to create your own templates for .NET New.
So, Jason, do you remember like when we first started this podcast, I had like this really, really big fascination with this little plugin called Sidewaffle?
Yes. And you talked about it for the next 15, 16 episodes.
Yeah. So the author of this is the author of Sidewaffle, and this is what Sidewaffle turned into.
Oh, I didn't know that. Okay.
So this is actually all of that project templates, those item templates that you could create really easily, mm-hmm. is now built into Visual Studio with this template generator. And if you want to find more about the template engine is exactly what it's called. You can read this article and learn how to start building your own templates like Sidewaffle started back in the day, but now it's built into the tooling.
Okay. So how are you controlling yourself these days? you gotta be pretty excited about this.
I am pretty excited. So I think the one drawback is, however, though, you need to be using .NET Core. So it won't work with like any project type like Sidewaffle could back in the day. But, you know, this is, once again, something new that's being put back in. So as we progress further and further, this will support more and more.
Awesome. Oh, let's see. Oh, and this is my favorite news story on the touring completeness of PowerPoint. This video is hilarious. It was funny because I always click on all the news items, and then I ended up, there was something else I was looking at for a while, and the video just started playing and I really wasn't listening to it. And then all of a sudden I started like listening to what he was talking about, the capabilities in PowerPoint, and he starts building this touring engine. And I started laughing, you know, like really laughing out loud, like, you know, by myself. This video is just hilarious. He uses the animation engine. Actually, where I lost it was whenever he had PowerPoint TM, and then he put TM after that, and then he TM'd that, and then he took the whole thing in parentheses and put a TM after that. This video is just hilarious, but he basically built, you know, a computational engine out of PowerPoint. And then he went on to show that this is actually the version that's in the Apple Store is in violation of their terms of service, because you can't have, you know, basically a computer that's capable of running like arbitrary code in the App Store. So
which
he
this becomes.
Yeah. So he argued that PowerPoint should be pulled from the from the Apple App Store.
Is this like people who use Excel to render cells as like pixels to make Doom?
Yeah, exactly. This is basically the same thing, except PowerPoint was never meant to do computation. But if you look at the length he went through to do this, it's pretty ridiculous.
See, now someone from the
office, only like a 5-minute.
What was that?
Someone from the Word team now needs to step up and show that Word can compete at this level.
Yeah, I mean, we should just have checkboxes like, okay, Excel, powerful, PowerPoint, powerful.
Okay.
We need OneNote. We need Word. I emailed this guy. I got permission to use this video after the end credits in our video version. Maybe I'll put it in the audio version. I'll have to listen and see if it still makes sense or not. But the video version for sure will have this video after the end credits. I've also referred him to our internship program to get this guy hired over here. This is the kind of talent we're looking for. this is great though. Any other comments on this?
Nope.
Yeah, definitely stay by after the credits and watch the video on that one. Okay, so let's talk about the Azure CLI, because I think it was a couple episodes ago where we had this as a news item that the Azure CLI version 2 was out, and I really knew almost nothing about it. And I said, you know, we should really have somebody, and you know, somebody who knows what they're talking about on the show to, you know, explain how it works, why it's cool, how to use it, those types of things. So that's why you're here.
Yeah,
go ahead.
Let's jump into some of the you can't talk about CLIs without talking about PowerShell. So I think we should probably start a little bit with PowerShell.
Yeah, give us the background.
Yeah, so what we're talking about here is, how do you manage Azure from a command line? And the typical answer has been, use PowerShell, use the Azure PowerShell commandlets, and you can do anything that you could do in Portal, you could do it in PowerShell. And that was a pretty good story for people who use PowerShell, who had a .NET or an object model mindset. But then you look and there's a whole set of people who live off MacBooks, live off Linux, or live off multi-platform environments where they need to use run a script on a Windows machine running on a Linux machine. And we had a CLI, we call it the Azure XPLAT CLI, and it was written in Node.js, and it worked, it was functional. But as you started comparing PowerShell to the XPLAT CLI, PowerShell can do orders of magnitude more things. When a new feature came on, something like managed disks comes on, PowerShell would have been obviously where it went first, and then the XPLAT CLI when they got around to it. So this was a problem to a lot of our customers, to a lot of people who are interested in Azure. So what we did is we stopped the development on the 1.0 tool, and we said, what do we need to do to make a great tool that we can keep up to date with the Azure PowerShell commandlets? And we decided to start over and build it on top of Python. I imagine for a lot of people, seeing us have a Node-based CLI and then moving to a Python-based CLI was weird. But this is because when we talk to people who needed a non-PowerShell CLI, we're talking about system integrators, we're talking about other clouds or Linux distro providers. We saw that SUSE Linux built their own Python-based Azure CLI rather than use our Node one because they didn't want to support a full Node runtime to support the Azure commands.
I like how Node is all of a sudden too big.
Yeah. So we asked everybody, like, hey, what do you want us to use? And they all said Python. And we're like, okay, let's use Python. Great. So that's a
very scientific.
Yeah. You know, when you talk to your customers and you find 80% plus will say what you should do, you should probably listen to them.
Yeah.
Now, changing languages was not the goal here. That was just a byproduct. The real goal is we wanted something that was super easy to install. If you look at something like the AWS CLI or the Google CLI, it's you go to a web page, they tell you a command to type in your terminal, and it installs. If you looked at our old CLI, it was download Node, figure that out. And if you're a .NET guy, downloading Node wasn't the easiest thing for a long time. Then install us, and then figure out how to keep us in date, which changed depending on your install methodology. You might have had an MSI install, and then you didn't have a normal Node install, and then you upgrade the Node that isn't really there. It was kind of confusing for our customers. So we wanted to make it super easy. And one of the things that we did was we did not just upgrade the existing CLI and then say, now we're 2.0 and it's a full breaking change. So we actually made essentially a new CLI and they both exist and work side by side. The old CLI is invoked by the command Azure. So it'd be like Azure VM. And the new CLI is AZ VM. Less characters, does not conflict. But what this allowed us to do is we were able to integrate the two CLIs. So rather than telling customers, hey, you might know the 1.0 CLI, and now here's a new one with all new commands, have fun, we do things like if you log in with the old CLI, it logs you into the new CLI and vice versa.
Oh, really?
Yeah, if you change if you change your subscription, we'll automatically change it in the other CLI as well.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, so we're trying to
I had no idea you did that. That's really going like above and beyond, honestly.
Yeah, it's about making it easy for incremental adoption because if you have an existing set of scripts that run on a cron job, nothing is worse than Microsoft coming to you and saying, hey, those scripts, that's old style. You need to change that working, tested system to this new thing that we're just releasing now. So this gave us a chance to tell customers, hey, you need a new feature that's not available in the 1.0 CLI. You can continue to use 1.0 CLI and then just make the one command in the new CLI for the feature you want without ruining all your existing investments. Mm-hmm. So yeah.
Keep going.
Oh, so that's one part. Naturally easy to install. Nowadays, we're looking at APT Git. So you can do ATP Git, install Azure CLI. There's a few more steps than that. We have an MSI for Windows. So you don't even have to worry about what to do on a command line. And everything except for our MSI install, if you want to update it, you don't have to just randomly figure out or go to Google. It's AZ component update, and it just updates everything in your CLI. Now, easy install, updatable, that's great. But another thing we heard from users is if you are a Mac or Linux customer, you have a lot of muscle memory grepping things using awk, SED. Mm-hmm. And if you looked at our old CLI, we didn't make that easy. We like to do a lot of things that we did in .NET and just kind of put that out into this Node CLI. So every output line would get a info or a help or an error prefix, which then means if you want to get clean greppable output, you got to actually cut all that out. So we were seeing users with scripts where it's make a call to the CLI, slice out the top rows, slice out the bottom rows, slice out the first column, then, you know, run this awk on the remaining system. And then we make little changes, and those steps might have to change. So we focused on making sure we can work with the Linux-style tools. So we have an output called TSV, and it's tab-separated value, and it's new line for between records and tabs between columns, and clean. No headers, no row or column headers, just clean output. We also support things like standard in, standard out, and standard warning cleanly. Now, to a .NET person or to a PowerShell person, I believe there's like seven outputs or seven streams that you could output to. And that, you know, kind of made sense. But and Azure was kind of built in that model. But then as you look at the Linux world, you really only get an input, an output, and something for error information. So we redesigned everything to work cleanly in that model instead of just having stuff go in sometimes weird places. Same thing with tab completion. Linux users expect tab depletion. We have it now. Even where like you could look up your resource group without leaving the command line. You could do az group show and then do a dash n tab tab, and it'll list all your resource groups right there, and you just type the name of the one you want, you're good. So those right there are the two biggest ones, making it easy for customers to get and then be consistent.
Okay. Very cool.
So you mentioned that this is Python. As Microsoft puts a lot of things open source, is this tool open source as well?
This tool is open source, and we started this tool open source too. So if you go GitHub/Azure/Azure-CLI, you'll find us. If you have any issues or feedback, we're right there. We are really interested in being part of the open source ecosystem. Kind of a cool thing, when we were considering what tools you wanted to work with in the CLI, we started seeing like, okay, JSON documents are the lingua franca of the CLI and of the REST APIs. So working against these JSON documents is a core thing. We started looking at, okay, JQ is an existing tool out there, JQ.exe for people in the CMD world. And it allows you to transform your documents. And we looked at that and we said, oh, that's really cool. It's popular inside Microsoft. It's easy to, the code was easy to work with. But then we started talking to customers and we started noticing AWS uses a jQuery language called JamesPath that they invented. And the license allowed us to use it. So we said, rather than try to bring a new JSON processing language into the DevOps community, we'll just use one they're already familiar with JamesPath. So AWS and the Azure CLI use the exact same query language. So the dash dash query option in both CLIs is the same. This is really great for system integrators or people who are doing multi-cloud or where Azure might be their second cloud to an AWS or a G Cloud instance.
Yeah. I love this too, that we acknowledge like the existence of other companies. That's a big change.
Oh yeah. A lot
Even
of the
that seems so minor. It's great.
A lot of our customers, a lot of people might think that someone would come to Azure, and once they have Azure, they don't want AWS. Or if they go to AWS, they're not interested in Azure. But in reality, your cloud is still a point of failure. And as much as clouds are high reliability and cloud scale, you still want flexibility. If it's only just for negotiations and business reasons, you might need that flexibility. And so supporting two clouds shouldn't be a barrier of entry to get into Azure that, oh, now I need to learn an entire new thing. We want to try in the CLI to make that as easy as possible.
Yeah. I mean, I worked with a company that they had, you know, they were spending $1 million a year with AWS. They came over to Azure and, you know, spent significantly more than that. But, you know, it's like, hey, can you convert that workload over? And they're like, why should we convert that workload over? Like, that'd be a big pain in the butt. So, you know, that's just the reality too. I mean, this magical world, yeah, where you're all only using one vendor and doing one thing is, you know, obviously never realistic. So, it is great whenever there's some similarities there.
You know, speaking of using one thing, as you look at Azure, it's common for customers to use Portal for some of their tasks, to use Visual Studio for some of their tasks, to use something like Storage Explorer. But in the CLI, when we talk to especially the Linux folks, not as much the Mac folks, though there are definitely people there, but the Linux folks love everything to be invocable by the command line. So important to us is if you could do it in PowerShell, if you could do it in Portal, you should be able to do it in the CLI. And we're not 100% there, but right now when a new service team, like let's say the compute team who makes virtual machines and scale sets and those kind of services, when they release a new service and they publish their REST API, we actually generate the Python SDK based on that REST API, the Azure Python SDK. And then we generate the CLI based on top of that Azure or the Azure Python SDK. So just by the service releasing a feature, it gets added to this pipeline that gets it into the CLI. But we don't just stop there.
Oh, wait, there's more.
But wait, there's more.
Every, if you order now.
Every single command that comes in gets, you know, information like this parameter means blah, this command does blah, here's an example how to use it. We worked with the new documentation system of Microsoft, docs.microsoft.com, and now every single pull request that's merged in kicks off a new doc build that pulls in every single change and refreshes the doc. then every example and every sample in our doc system is automatically re-executed against that new version, and errors then come back to us and the doc team.
Oh, that's cool. I love that. That's why, yeah, Carl and I have been talking. We want to get somebody from the docs team on because that sounds pretty cool. Like actually having your documentation, you know, essentially throw like a build error and push it back. Because, I mean, there's nothing more frustrating where you're like copying a sample, right? And you're like kind of tweaking it. Why doesn't this work? Fine, I'll just go back. I'll just use the sample as it is. And then come to find out that doesn't work is super frustrating. So that I like that strategy.
And we used to have internal tools that, you know, kind of like you do this check-in and it runs this CI and it builds and it becomes an internal thing. But we wanted to be part of the open source community, which means I can't gate external people's pull requests off of an internal build documentation system. So this is our way of saying that anybody's pull request, anyone could submit documentation changes without worrying about breaking our whole doc site.
Espose offers a powerful set of file management APIs with which developers can create applications, which can create, open, edit, and save the majority of popular business file formats. Their product range supports a multitude of file formats, including Word documents, Excel spreadsheets, PowerPoint presentations, PDF documents, OneNote, Outlook, Project, Visio files, popular image formats, and many others. Espose produces APIs for .NET, Java, and the cloud, which can be utilized in almost any modern language available today. Visit www.espose.com for a free 30-day no-limitations trial. And if you get stuck, message the friendly support team for help. All technical support is offered free of charge. Remember, if you're a lucky winner, you will receive a free developer small business license for Espose.words for .NET, a powerful toolkit to work with Word documents in your applications.
So I installed the command line, and I actually did it through I did it through Bash through the Linux subsystem,
yep.
And so I was pleasantly surprised to find that the documentation. I thought I was going to be trying something exotic, but it was actually like the first section in the documentation, and I was like, oh, okay, I guess this is perfectly normal. So I installed it in Bash, and the installer was very good because it was a single line that I pasted in, and I actually have a script that configures like my Linux subsystem environment. Mm-hmm. I just paste it in anytime I set that environment up. And it was pretty slick because it ran, and actually, you know, normally I ignore like all the output of any kind of command that I run, and it didn't work. And here, then I ran it again. I actually read what it said, and it said, hey, you need to install these things. And it said, oh, by the way, here's the command line to run. So I just copied that. I pasted that in. It installed all the dependencies for me. Then I installed the command line. And what I thought was kind of interesting is the new login process, because historically this has been it was really goofy. You had like this XML file thing, this publish profile, and blah blah blah. It was kind of just awkward. So can you describe the new login process?
So our main form of login in, especially for interactive users, is what we call a device login, where you do AZ space login, and we give you a web link, ak.ms/device login, and I think it's like an 8 or 10 character code that you paste in there into this web page. And that web page will do your validation, and the CLI just keeps polling in the back to see if you have a valid login, and then it logs you in. But what you don't have to figure out is, where do you get this file? What format does it need to be in? What kinds of secrets do I need? Those are hard questions. Though, we should also talk a little bit about what happens when you want to go from an interactive login to a cron job. Because a lot of people then go, I want to run this. I want to shut off all my VMs when I leave work today. Midnight, shut off the VMs. But your login has expired, or you're not even logged on your machine. So service principles are the answer to this. But historically, they've required some difficulty creating. We put an amazing amount of effort into just cleaning up that process. So now we have a command, and we moved it recently, and I just got back from paternity leave, and so I don't want to say what it is because I'll mess it up, but it's something like AZ something create for SP, and it will automatically create a service principal, assign rights to your subscription. It'll give you an output of, here is how to assign new rights, here's how to look for new rights to assign, here's to identify resources for assigning rights to directly, and then here's how to delete the whole thing.
I like that.
And then you can just take that. Oh, and then also we give you the line of code of like, cut and paste this, and this is your line of code to log in. So you just cut and paste that, put it in the top of your script, and you're good to go.
That's awesome, because that's always a huge hassle.
Yeah, big deal for a lot of Java developers. And I believe this is more of a .NET focused podcast, but Java developers love working with service principles, and this makes it so much easier.
So speaking of using different technologies, I mean, jumping back a little bit, you mentioned that Linux users love being in the command line a lot more than like Mac or Windows people. But do you have like any kind of breakdown of the usage by OS or technology?
Right about now, I looked up before we talked today, we're about 60% Windows command line, which might feel very high. But as you look internally, this tool has been used more heavily internally than externally because we're a new tool. And we're talking about a tool that manages Azure writ large. A lot of companies don't want to be doing production systems out of a beta tool. So a lot of our early usage was in Windows. I mean, started building up more and more Windows usage. As we GA'd in February and as we're GA'ing more and more services, we're starting to see our Mac and Linux usage climb. As we talk about accounts, it's probably another interesting thing to mention. Right now, we're tracking our usage based on subscription ID. So each unique subscription we count as one user. This is just a point in time thing for us. We're looking for better metrics to identify users. And we started seeing that patterns like .NET users may have a few more subscriptions in their accounts than some of our Linux users. And so we started to see some really cool usage patterns between Linux and Windows and Mac and Windows just by looking at the telemetry of the CLI.
Mm-hmm. That's very interesting. So, you know, we sort of covered this earlier, and it's probably kind of obvious, but I just wanted to kind of touch on this point again. You know, there's the PowerShell version, and now, I mean, PowerShell goes cross-platform. So theoretically, I could use the PowerShell CLI across all platforms. I could also use the V1 CLI across all platforms. Mm-hmm. And now we have the CLI 2.0. So I really have like three options to choose from. So is it just cut and dry? I mean, like if anybody who's listening, who's like, well, which one should I use? I mean, should they all be using the new one?
So the first separation is between PowerShell and CLI. If you have existing investments in PowerShell, scripts, it might be resources that you've hired. PowerShell is a great tool and is an answer for you. But we want to make sure that we didn't provide just one right tool, but we gave the companies the right tools for for the options they need. If you have Linux expertise, if that's what you invested in, Azure CLI 2 will provide the same benefits as PowerShell. That's our goal.
Okay.
Now, Azure CLI 1, one of the reasons that we've moved away from it is the Azure service model, ASM, some people call it RDFE. And specifically, let's talk cloud services. Cloud services is one of the largest non-ARM services in Azure. And the model...
When you say ARM, you mean Azure Resource Manager.
Yeah, Azure Resource Model.
It's confusing for our listeners, probably. not ARM processors.
Yes, not ARM processors. These are the templates and the structure of resources in Azure. We call it ARM for management. This is things like resource groups. In ASM, resource groups doesn't exist as a concept. And as a result, when we switched from ASM to ARM, everything changed. And we used the same CLI for both. And we'd use Azure Mode ARM or Azure Mode ASM to tell you which one you're in. But very few customers understood the difference. And when they went to someone else's computer, the commands were different. They wouldn't know why. They reinstalled commands were different. They wouldn't know why. They upgrade commands were different. They wouldn't know why. So we basically said the ASM model is stopping at the XPLAT CLI. And we're going to keep the XPLAT CLI alive, healthy, and supported until ASM is no longer a requirement for working with Microsoft technologies.
Okay. So if you're a new user though, then it sounds like you have a choice between PowerShell and the cross-plat CLI, right? Okay. So both of those will continue to move on. And if you're doing ASM, then you use the V1 CLI.
Yes. And you'll find that new ARM features will no longer post-build be included in the XPLAT CLI ARM functionality. And then it's really just going to be there for existing ASM customers.
Okay.
Another reason you might want to consider we should talk a little bit about Polyglot developers, because Polyglot developers are a really big deal for us in the Azure Developer Tools division or group. So right now, if you do file new project in a Visual Studio ASP.NET webpage, you get things like Bower and Gulp. And now you start saying, like, what does it mean to be a polyglot developer? You could be a .NET developer, and you still can't get away from the node tool chains, from working with JavaScript, let alone things like the React and Angular. Everyone's a polyglot developer. If you find yourself working in that world where you're working near JSON, where you're working with tools like Gulp and task runners, if you're working a lot with VSTS, you might find yourself with a little more joy in the Azure CLI just because it's next to all those tools on your command line. PowerShell is also able to do all those things, but for some users who aren't already into PowerShell, they might find an easier time working with the CLI instead of PowerShell, just because of the simpler object model, i.e. lack of an object model.
Mm-hmm. Now my next question is around, you know, if you look at Azure is this thing that always moves forward, right? I mean, there's changes every day that are happening underneath the hood. And sometimes the API itself will change in some way, whereas the command line is something I download, and it has an understanding of what Azure looks like, what those interfaces look like, but it doesn't change, right, unless you actually update it. So how do you, and even if you update it, maybe you guys didn't do it, I don't know, how do you keep those things in sync so that whenever I'm using the command line, I'm always talking to Azure in the way that it expects to be talked to?
Yeah, this is the topic of API versions in Azure. This is not a simple topic for customers. Even internally, this is a very contentious, difficult conversation over the past couple of years. Yeah. We're right now working on closing down how we're going to handle in the CLI what we call profiles. And the idea with a profile is you'll have a date string that gives you a specific point in time self-consistent list of Azure modules. So that might be a GA version of storage, compute, networking, and a preview version of managed disks and DocDB, and a, you know, beta version of something else. And then we also will have a latest that's just the freshest, newest of everything. And so if you're in the CLI, we would assume you want to work with the latest. And every time you tell the CLI to update, it will update all your components automatically to a self-consistent latest version. So you don't have to worry about this resource provider module is out of date versus this resource provider module. This is super important as you start talking about on-premise clouds. One of the benefits of Azure is this consistent cloud idea where you can build an application to deploy in your data center or deploy in a government cloud or deploy in public Azure, and you don't need to change anything. But the resources available in each of these might be different, so you may need to start programming towards a lowest common denominator amongst those. You might not be able to use the newest VM feature because that VM feature didn't make it to your on-premise Azure stack yet. So right. These profiles will be our answer to cleanly work with this. You find what the lowest common denominator is across all your clouds, and we'll even help you find out what that is. We'll do something like AZ profile list, and it'll tell you what all the profiles in all your clouds are, what the latest and what the least common denominator, the greatest least common denominator is for between them all. And then you just do AZ profile set that string, and it will create a new environment of your CLI built with it'll download all the right modules for that version of the API profiles, and keep that side by side with the latest version. And you can have as many of those as you want and switch between them with AZ profile switch. It'll just switch you between each of those. So this will make it really easy where people aren't going to have to worry about, like, how do they build up what the right API version is to put in their query string when they're doing REST APIs. But if you exist at a SDK level, this probably won't mean as much to you, short of it'll be easy to figure out what the right SDK is.
So how do I pull down profiles then?
Yes. We'll be including
profiles. So as the APIs update, then you pull down new profiles?
Yep, exactly.
Okay, I got you.
And those will be a curated list by the company.
Okay.
So before we mention that this is an open source project on GitHub, I was wondering what some of the major contributions from the public has been to this so far.
So we've gotten kind of three sets of contributions. One of the first things being an internal project where we were reaching out to other service teams who had an existing CLI they were building components for. we wanted to go to all of them and say, we can build a CLI super cheaply, super effectively, and you'll like it more than the current one. And we had our team, and it was five developers, do all that work. And that got us, you know, the main IaaS environments, VMs, networking, storage, that kind of stuff, ARM. But then we wanted to get more things. We wanted things like SQL, DocDB, express routes. We wanted more complex things, but we didn't have to write every single one of them, become domain experts every single one of them. So the first thing that we did with being open source is we could go to any internal team and say, here is our code, here's access to it, you could submit a PR for your service, and that's it, done. And that model worked really great. We got a lot of internal teams building their own Python components, even without having deep Python expertise, and that our team validates all those PRs. Then as we started to get more public, we started seeing more external people commit to or start talking with us. I don't know of any, off the top of my head, great PRs we've taken from the external community, but we've gotten a lot of feedback about the PRs we've gotten from the Microsoft MVPs, the regional directors, and the community writ large. I think last time I looked, our issue list was 30% external on GitHub.
Okay.
Though I have not checked that in a bit.
Okay. So, I mean, with the, this thing, I mean, it looks great and it's a great feature set. So, you know, like what kind of more like forward looking things can we look forward to? Is there any roadmap items that you can share with us?
Yeah. So profiles is something we're excited about, but it's kind of like,
yeah,
you know, a loud clap in a very depopulated area. Not many people are going to hear it, but the thing that we're really excited about, we built the CLI because we needed it to be used in automated scriptable tools. You need it to be something that you could put in your workflow. That means clean inputs, clean outputs. When something succeeds, there is no output. It returns a success, and there's no output because you don't want it to pollute your next tool in the line.
Yeah.
That, though, makes it really hard to just quickly investigate the CLI, do things like, which of my VMs are running right now? Well, I might have to do a dash H to look up the help, and then I might need to look up some parameters. And it kind of slowed it down, especially me building scripts and demos for customers. So we built what we call the AZ shell. There's a blog post out on it. We'll have a link in the show notes. And what this is this is a interactive shell. So at your bash command line, right now it's a separate tool. Come build time, it'll actually be AZ space shell. It'll go right into this mode. And it gives you a text editor at the top. And then at the bottom, it gives you for, let's say you do AZVM, it'll tell you all the commands, all the parameters. It'll tell you, it'll give you examples. And if you want to run an existing example or move that example into your text space, we have gestures to do that. So you can do like a colon one and it'll just say, okay, run that first example, but with these parameters. Some of our examples for VM creation, if you want to create multiple NICs or you want to do express routes, some of those examples get complicated and you just want to change a name or resource group. We could do that with this. If you work all the time in Service Bus, what you would want would be something like AZ, SB, and then all your commands are up there. So you just want to skip the AZSB.
Yeah.
We have caret, AZSB. Every command from that point on assumes you're starting at AZSB.
Oh, cool.
And then SB, caret, and it undoes that. And you can go up levels, down levels. We have multiple colorizations. We're even trying to work on things where we'll automatically color JSON output. There's a lot of cool features in interactive shell that we're really excited about. In preview now. People can get it. Like I said, we'll have the link. And then in build, we're just going to put it right into the CLI. Because in preview, when we got feedback from customers, turns out trying to keep two of the same product, the AZ interactive shell and the AZ CLI, in sync is kind of hard for customers, especially non-Python-focused developers. So we just built it in. Why not?
That's very cool. Very cool.
So is there anything else that we failed to ask you that you want to mention about this?
No, only that this is the Azure CLI is one of the most exciting tools for managing Azure. And if you only occasionally manage Azure, I think many people would find more success in the CLI than they would in the portal, the online portal. And if you find yourself frustrated by your experience in the portal, give the CLI a shot for your workflow. You might find it good.
Yeah, I've been thinking about doing like a 30-day challenge where, like, you know, I only go to the portal if I can't do it with the command line for some reason.
Oh, you'll learn so much about when you do that.
Yeah.
Yeah,
very cool, and I love it.
We live in the CLI today where everything that we do has to be done in CLI internally on our team. So it's like, oh, this is auto scale is one that we're looking at right now. This is how you would do auto scale in the portal. And then we go like, okay, let's do that in CLI. Oh, this is hard stuff. Really focus on making those things easier. Kind of forgot where I started.
Very cool. Okay, Carl, what do we have for the Azure pick of the week?
The Azure pick of the week is a really cool blog post that highlights the Azure Document DB query playground.
Yep.
So this is a nice little interactive place where you can work on, you know, just writing some queries and see how they affect DocDB. And to couple this, this blog post, well, it has a link to the actual query playground itself. It also has a DocumentDB SQL query cheat sheet, just because the SQL that you use for DocDB is slightly different than T-SQL, most of it being that it's not a full subset, or it's not a, it doesn't have the full feature set as T-SQL. So you can see what is available and then go play around with it right away too. So that's where I think that this is really cool.
Yeah, this is really cool. Where?
And we lost Jason.
Equals baby food. Let's see here. Cool.
DocDB is That's really cool. The perf you get out of DocDB, it's insane.
Yeah. I mean, it's such a neat service being able to, you know, just take your JSON document and say, save this for me. And I, in particular, I like the MongoDB interface.
Yep.
I find that client is a lot easier to use right off the bat. I mean, you can literally start using DocDB. Well, in the command line, it's probably like two lines in the command line. And then in your code, I mean, it's just it's like two or three lines of code and boom, you're working with DocumentDB. And, you know, cause I don't want to run a server. What a pain. Like that just anytime, you know, now anything that's like not Azure Functions to me, like seems really complicated.
It's not just even standing up your DocDB. It's then going your DocDB cloud scale and making it multi-regional. So easy with DocDB. Try doing that with some of the external products. It's hard.
Yeah, no. Okay. Carl, what do you for the dev tip of the week?
The dev tip of the week is for our Windows developers. The UWP Community Toolkit is now up to a version 1.4. And while they do have like new controls and stuff that you can work with and other new like extension methods and features like that, one of the cool things is they actually have this time around some developer tools that'll help you either bring like an alignment grid so you can make sure everything's aligned properly or to make sure that you have the right thing focused. So they have a few new tools in there to help you during the development phase as well as the actual implementation of your application. So if you're a Windows developer making UWP applications, you definitely want to check out the UWP Community Toolkit.
Very cool. Okay, Jason, there's a game that we play in the show. What I need to do is I need you to pick a number between 1 and 4 inclusive and let me know what it is.
Say it aloud.
Yeah.
3.
And well, unless you have another way of letting me know, I guess. Okay, let me find a card with an unused 3. Okay, here we go. This probably doesn't make any sense, but it's a kid's game. Would you rather have to change your little brother's diapers or clean your grandmother's false teeth?
So I have a 3.5-year-old and a 5-month-old baby. I got to the first 1.5 years on my 3.5-year-old without changing a diaper and 4 months on my baby without changing a diaper. So I'm going to go with grandma's teeth and mention my wife, Kelly, is a saint.
Oh, so nice. So you're just, you know, you just know that if you do one, then that just opens up the floodgates.
Yeah, that starts the floodgates and then downhill from there. But
sorry, honey, I'm cleaning grandma's teeth. I can't change the diaper right now. Okay, Carl, you pick a number.
I'll take number 2.
Number 2. Man, we've gone through a lot. We've gone through a lot of these cards. Here we go. Would you rather always keep one eye closed or only breathe out of your nose?
One eye closed.
Really? Why?
I got to be able to breathe, man.
Well, yeah. I mean, what if your nose gets stuffed up? I mean, do they give you like a pass if that happens or not?
Probably not.
Yeah. And like, who's the judge? and what's the penalty? I always said on Doctor Who, they could, you know, whenever you have the weeping angels where you have to keep looking at them, you just alternate between those eyes. okay. So Jason, where can people find you?
So anyone can get talk to the Azure CLI team. We are azfeedback@microsoft.com. We're @AzureCLI on Twitter. And if you're looking to get started, aka.ms/AzureCLI2.
Okay. Very cool. Very cool. And Carl, where can people find you?
You can find me on Twitter @CarlSchweitzer.
And you can find me at ytechie.com or on Twitter @twitter.com/ytechie. So Jason, thank you so much for coming on here and talking about this. This was perfect timing and great work on this new command line tool.
Oh, it's great to be able to talk with you. Thanks.
My name is Tom, and in this presentation, I will present my breakthrough research on solving computational problems using PowerPoint. I will explore to what extent PowerPoint can replace conventional programming languages, as well as the benefits and limitations of using PowerPoint for such purposes. But first, a quick disclaimer. This presentation is not sponsored or endorsed by any real or hypothetical corporation located in Redmond, Washington. The views and opinions expressed are those of the author and do not necessarily reflect those of any such corporation should one exist. Only trained PowerPoint professionals should attempt to reproduce the results of this research, and the author will not be held responsible for any material, physical, or emotional damages caused by such attempts. So with that out of the way, we can proceed to the background. So as you may know, PowerPoint has hyperlinks and animations, which can be used to add interactivity to your presentations. So we have links here, and then we also have animations, which are particularly interesting because you can trigger them in different orders. So you can use these to make interesting things like applications, games, you know, typical things that you'd make in a slideshow editor. But until recently, it has been unproven as to whether you can do all things using PowerPoint, whether you can solve every computational problem with a dedicated PowerPoint file. And this is largely because in order to prove such a claim, you would need to create a Turing machine that runs in PowerPoint, or you'd have to be able to show that every Turing machine can be run within PowerPoint. So without further ado, the palindrome recognizing Turing machine. So here we have a Turing machine that decides the language palindromes of even length. So you can see that, like a normal Turing machine, we can move this tape. This is implemented completely with animations. There are no macros or anything else. So I can write to the tape, of course, so we'll give it a simple input like this. And of course, I can also execute the Turing machine. So here we have the Turing machine's current state, and in order to continue execution, unfortunately this doesn't happen automatically, it needs a little bit of encouragement, the user has to click on each orange region. Now you might be concerned here that I'm making decisions whenever I'm clicking on this, but the way that this PowerPoint is set up, every other area is blocked, so I can click randomly essentially, and the PowerPoint will just advance its computation. So that was the input 1-1. So this should end up being accepted, and we can see that it does indeed end on an accepting state. And I could rerun that with another input, and it would reject accordingly, depending on what it is. So this is nice, but what we'd really like to be able to do is run any Turing machine in PowerPoint. Fortunately, this is easy because the PowerPoint Turing machine is programmed entirely using punch cards. So for example, this card says that whenever the Turing machine is in state 0 and it reads a 1, then it should write a blank, move to the right, and then move to state 2. But if we change where these holes are located, we can make the Turing machine do something else and essentially imitate any transition function of any other Turing machine. All of this is accomplished using over 1,600 animations and around 700 auto-shapes. The cross-link Turing machine offers a number of advantages over alternative programming languages, offering cross-platform support running on both mobile devices and both commercially relevant desktop operating systems. In addition, its drag-and-drop programming means there's no text and no syntax errors. But most importantly, you can use themes, WordArt, and transitions that PowerPoint is infamous for in your code. It requires asymptotically fewer auto-shapes than when implemented in alternative slideshow editors, definitively proving PowerPoint to be exponentially more capable than competing software. But perhaps most notably, the PowerPoint Turing machine shows that the PowerPoint iOS app is in violation of Apple's App Store guidelines, and it shows that PowerPoint can emulate alternative apps and execute arbitrary code. In the future, I'd like to research making PowerPoint code more scalable and optimized, so that one day, every application you run on your computer can be run within PowerPoint.